Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with best-selling author and part-time New Orleanian Laura Lippman, whose new book is After I'm Gone. Novelist Wiley Cash talks about his time in Louisiana and his new book, This Dark Road to Mercy. And artist Lisa Siegel tells us why she's chosen Teju Cole's Open City for the Prospect 3 reading series. I am so happy to spend time with my next guest, the best-selling author, Laura Lippman, although I feel like I've spent a lot of time with her over the past 19 years. While she's been writing, is it 19 books?
I think this is my 19th novel,
so
yes.
These books have steadily drawn readers into the world you've created in Baltimore, the world of Tess Monahan and so many other women living there. Laura's most recent book is After I'm Gone, and it is one of her standalone novels inspired by a real-life event. Laura, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you. It's so great to be here in person.
Now, you gave your husband, David Simon, some props for the idea of this story.
Yeah, I think if you're going to suggest a novel to me, you will probably need to be married to me to be taken very seriously at all, which is not to say that people don't have good ideas, but it's so intimate and it's such a long-term project to be with a novel, even over the course of a year, that you have to be very passionate about it. And it's hard for other people to know what will engage you passionately. And David probably proposed this idea several times over. And he would always come to it from the point of view of what was known, what was true, which was there was a man in Baltimore, Julius Salisbury, ran a very successful number running racket, got caught on a relatively minor federal charge, but the feds, for whatever reason, gave him a pretty tough sentence, 15 years. And he was appealing that sentence when he disappeared, presumably on his own initiative, escaping to another country, possibly Israel. He had bought a lot of Israeli war bonds. But no one really knew. And so David would bring that up to me and say, and I bet you could find out. I bet you could solve the mystery. And I said, I mean, I left the newspaper so I don't have to solve real life mysteries anymore. Then one day he said something that just really stuck out for me. He was sort of filling me in on the biography of Julius Salisbury. And he said, well, you know, his girlfriend was Pam Gale. She worked on the block down in Baltimore in a club. This is a strip club that Julius owned. And he was married. He had three daughters. And all of a sudden I was like, okay, wait a minute. Now I'm interested, but I'm interested in the five women. I'm interested in how they would have defined themselves in his absence, which was permanent. He never came back. And I read very little about the real life case. I couldn't even tell you the name of Julius Salisbury's wife, although I know she had a very different background than the one I made up for Bambi Brewer in the book. But she did talk about what it was like to watch her husband walk down the front steps and know that she would never see him again.
Wow. The other thing, though, is that in this book, one of the things I love the most about it is that they're not just defining themselves in regard to his absence. They're all in this shifting constellation of relationships with each other. And so much of it is about all those complicated roles that women live out.
Mothers, daughters, sisters. You know, the girlfriend is quite isolated. I found that the book is a really fascinating litmus test for the reader. I'm very interested now to see which character readers gravitate to. One person said to me, well, I'm not interested in the girlfriend, Julie, because that is a choice that I don't approve of. But boy, am I interested in Bambi, the wife. And my husband, not to me, but in my hearing, has said repeatedly how interested he is in the youngest daughter, who is so spoiled and seems at times so incapable of redemption, but turns out to make some decisions that are honorable and admirable and is rewarded sort of beyond any logical conclusion. You know, she gets more than she deserves out of this life somehow.
She's also really funny. She has the funniest line in this whole book.
Which line is that?
Make the bread before you go-go.
That's right. That's right. When she gives her speech at her bat mitzvah and she relates her section of the Torah to a Wham song.
I love that so much.
Thank you.
I actually laughed out loud when I read it. But the other thing this book is about, which always fascinates me so much, is it's about women and money.
It's definitely about money. Oh, of course it's about women, but I'm really interested in money. And I think it's very interesting that mainstream literary novels for a long time eschewed it. I have some theories about that. One is that a lot of mainstream literary novels were written by people who were tenured academics, and this was not a concern that was uppermost in their minds. That might be part of it. It doesn't explain everyone. To go back to something like Madame Bovary, which is all about the money, mm-hmm. and the seeds of her destruction are sown in her bookkeeping. And I've read that Flaubert was so meticulous about exactly what was happening to Emma Bovary in terms of her finances. And then you come into the 20th century, into the 21st century, and money disappeared for a long time from literary novels. It was always there in the crime novel. It's always been a central facet of crime novels.
Of course, follow the money.
Exactly. What's exciting to me is I'm seeing more and more literary writers take on the subject. If you read Capital by John Lancaster, the Adam Haslett book, is it Union Atlantic? Even Jess Walters, The Financial Lives of the Poets, which is sort of on a micro level about what happens to one person in the new economy. I'm really heartened by those books. Also, Lionel Shriver's So Much for All That, mm-hmm. which is very much about our healthcare system. It was an incredibly wonderful and timely book. So I've seen that shifted, but money is still a topic that the crime writers sort of have dibs on. I mean, I think the day-to-day, the quotidian, how do you pay the bills? What do you do for a living? What are you wearing? What are you eating? All of those things always fascinate me, and I look for it in the books that I read. And, you know, I feel very strongly about telling the stories of women, about giving voice to women. I've become extremely attuned in our culture and all the ways in which women are told to shut up.
Right.
It's a running motif. It came up most recently in this wonderful discussion about what happens to women on the internet who have strong and often well-researched opinion pieces that run afoul of certain interest groups, and how those women are then diminished via their gender. You know, people Photoshop their faces onto bathing suit shots or lingerie shops, that they sexualize them, that women who carry unwelcome messages will be mocked, and it's an attempt to silence them. I mean, the internet is a particularly rowdy place and knows no bounds when it comes to trying to get a discussion to stop. And I think we've seen that, you know, I just said to someone this very morning on Facebook, can we at least acknowledge that we should perhaps lean less heavily on he said, she said, because so often it means he said, she said, and the world said, la, 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 I can't hear you.
Right. Oh, and it's all about power. We've been talking with Laura Lippman, whose new novel is After I'm Gone. Take my advice and don't start it until you have time to finish it, because once you read that first page, you won't be able to stop. Thank you so much, Laura. Oh,
thank you so much for having me. Tailgating Tina, your filthy Wilhelmina. Your man had been seen with a long lanky Lena. Hugging French kissing, all the love you missing. Give them bumps a mighty heart attack. And maybe you can catch him in a hat. Back down the alley, they're rocking the rally. Best not dilly-dally, they shame your name, Sweet Sally. Sneak up, take a peek up, crawl a heathen creeper. Give them bumps a mighty heart attack.
Wiley Cash is one of those Southern writers who has already created his own world, putting his stamp on his home state of North Carolina in a very distinctive way. In his first novel, A Land More Kind Than Home, a New York Times bestseller, he took us into the world of small towns where religion is embraced like a drug and snakes are everywhere. In his second novel, This Dark Road to Mercy, we visit Gastonia, and a different world of foster homes and baseball in a distinctive American road novel of a father trying to reconnect with his two daughters. Wiley Cash, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Well, we first met at the Louisiana Book Festival some time ago, and it's been such a pleasure to watch your success and rejoice in it. And you have a very strong tie to Louisiana as well.
I do, yeah. I went to graduate school in Lafayette from 2003 to 2008, and I studied under Ernest J. Gaines, and I go back a lot to Louisiana. I'll actually be down there for the St. Francis Phil Book Festival at the end of February and an event at Octavia Books in New Orleans a few days before that. So I go back every chance I get.
You came to Louisiana to write about North Carolina, eh?
I did. It was kind of funny. I didn't intend to. You know, I went to Louisiana, to Lafayette, purposely to study under Ernest Gaines. And, you know, I'd always wanted to write stories and maybe write a novel one day, but I didn't know necessarily what I was going to write about or what the focus was going to be. But I got down to Louisiana, and it was so different from North Carolina, you know, and although I love Louisiana, I still do. It's a second home. It made me homesick for North Carolina, and I realized that's what I wanted to write about.
Well, sometimes you have to go away to see clearly, don't you think?
Yeah, I tell people, and this is a comparison I've used many times, that, you know, when you're doing laundry and you find a sock and you say, is this sock blue or black? And then you hold it up beside a black sock and you think, how could I have ever thought this sock was anything but blue? That's kind of what it was like leaving North Carolina and going to Louisiana. You know, they're both in the South, but they're so different.
Oh, very much so. So what did you learn from Ernest Gaines? I think of him as one of our great, great teachers, not just of literature, but of humanity.
Yeah, absolutely. I learned from him to embrace the place you're from, you know, warts and all. He never pulled any punches writing about slavery and the Civil War with the autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman or racial discrimination or violence and A Lesson Before Dying. So I kind of decided to do the same thing in writing about North Carolina, warts and all. You know, there are wonderful things about the places we're from, and there are not so wonderful things about the places we're from. And if you want to write in the vein of realism, you have to write about both the good and the bad, and that's what I learned from that.
And the other thing I like about the University of Louisiana at Lafayette is that there's such a sense of community.
Yeah, there is. I mean, Lafayette is just such an amazing city. It's one of those cities that's on the verge of becoming like Austin or like another culturally vibrant place. And to be honest with you, I hope it always stays on the verge. I hope it never crosses over because I like it being this wonderful secret. But it is such a culturally distinct place with the university and the wonderful culture of Acadiana. It's just great.
And now in This Dark Road to Mercy, just as in A Land More Kind Than Home, you have a young narrator, this time a girl, Easter Quilby, who tells her part of the story. What is it that attracts you to these young voices as narrators?
I think it's because the emotional landscape of children, and by that I mean, you know, school-age children. The narrator of my first novel was 9 and Easter's 12. What attracts me is their emotional landscape, you know, their emotional resonance. So many things affect them on incredibly deep levels that don't affect adults. So there's a scene in the novel where Easter's being picked on by some older kids, and it's just devastating. Whereas for an adult, something like that wouldn't bother them quite as much because they can disarm themselves a little better than children can. And I think children as narrators are so incredibly honest because they haven't learned the protective devices that adults use when they're keeping things from other people about themselves. You know, you can't trust an adult narrator as much as you can a child because I feel like children really divulge everything they can to you because they don't know what may or may not get them in trouble down the road.
So true. So set the stage for us with Easter. Tell us what This Dark Road to Mercy is about.
It's about a washed-up minor league baseball player who kidnaps his two daughters from a foster home in Gastonia, North Carolina, and tries to go on the run and be a father to them. But unbeknownst to them, at least at first, he's also gotten a hold of some stolen money he has no business holding on to. And so he's being pursued by this ruthless bounty hunter who has an old vendetta against the father. And he's also being pursued by the girl court-appointed legal guardian, an ex-police officer. So he has these two guys looking for him, you know, one who's looking for him for good reasons and one who's looking for him for bad reasons. Caught in the crosshairs are these two little girls who didn't ask for any of this and are really just hoping for a family, something they've always dreamed of having.
And it's all set against that background of baseball.
It is, yeah, and it's set against the 1998 home run race in particular, the race between Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa. That's really the thing that kind of saved baseball. You know, 1998 was kind of a very negative time in American history and politics with the scandals going on in the White House and all the things we had going on there. But the baseball really brought a reason for us to kind of come together and turn on our TVs every night, sit down together as a nation and pull for these two guys, you know, who were, you know, kind of bringing the American pastime back to the focus of the country. And then you find out, you know, a decade later that it was all a big lie, that the thing we believed in and were so hopeful for didn't really exist. And so this novel, what I'm kind of asking readers to do is to look again at our assumptions about people, whether they're good or whether they're bad.
Well, I have to tell you, the bad guy, Pruitt, is bad. He's really, really bad. How much fun was that to write as a character?
It was fun, but it was worrisome, too, because he's narrated in the first person.
Yeah.
And so I think the natural thing for readers when they see a character who speaks in the first person, they may assume that's an extension of the writer. And I certainly know people don't think that about myself and Pruitt. But he was fun. You know, I realized that this was a really good chance for me to explore a deep darkness in American culture and in vengeance and violence and fear. And so every time that Pruitt was on the page, I wanted the reader to feel that they were sinking lower and lower into the depths of darkness. And he starts off in one place, which is scary enough, and then he ends in a place where he's just totally and completely out of control. And so he was really, really fun. It was really interesting to kind of plumb those dark spaces, and especially have him tell you about himself while he's doing it.
Well, I felt it. He was really disturbing, but great, great fun to read. And then there's Brady Weller, who is the court-appointed guardian of Easter and her sister Ruby. And he is such a flawed but persevering human being who's just trying to do what's right for them.
Yeah, you know, I think that Brady is kind of the everyman. And, you know, in my first novel, I had a sheriff named Clem Bearfield who was kind of the everyman. He was the narrator that readers could kind of latch on to and say, this is the person I identify with. This is going to be my eyes, both physically and emotionally, in this novel. And I think Brady is that way in This Dark Road to Mercy for the reader as well. But he's a little more complicated than the sheriff was in my first book, because he's made some major mistakes in his past. And towards the end of the novel, he has to make a really tough decision about these girls' future and what he thinks is going to be best for them. And I wanted readers to feel caught in his decision. I really wanted them to feel for him, but also maybe second-guess him, as they perhaps would second-guess themselves.
Oh, absolutely. It's such a terrific book with so many unforgettable characters. And, you know, this is your second book, so you sort of come into your own. We've been talking with Wiley Cash, whose terrific new novel is This Dark Road to Mercy. You can meet him Thursday, February 20th at 6 at Octavia Books. Thank you so much, Wiley.
Thank you. I look forward to coming back to the city.
Prospect 3, the citywide art project that takes place in October this year, is ramping up with a series of reading and book discussions. The series began with a discussion of The Moviegoer by Walker Percy last month, and February brings a new addition to the P3 Reads series. Award-winning artist Lisa Siegel will be discussing her chosen book, Open City by Teju Cole, with James Borders IV, that's February 19th at the Norman Mayer Library. Lisa is an artist who works in combinations of painting, sculpture, and architecture, exploring the meanings of inside and outside, boundaries, structure itself. Her most recent works are a series of hinged paintings, which make us think anew about the objective nature of art and painting. And she is speaking to us from Brooklyn, where she lives and works. Lisa, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you for having me.
Prospect 1 and 2, you know, have made us think about our city in new ways, about cities in general, too, of course. And you are very much an artist of the urban landscape. What is it about that that inspires you?
I was talking to a friend the other day about living in the city, especially a city like New York, which is really a very walkable city. And I was just thinking about all the paths that are really well-worn in our lives and the paths that take us from the store, to home, to work, to the studio, and then back again. And just how those everyday paths, the ones that we walk on, are almost the paths that we have our eyes closed on or our eyes wide shut. And what interests me is the walks that actually wake me up and make me see as an outsider. And when I turn a corner in New York and bump into a culture. I don't know. I find myself, or maybe I lose myself, in neighborhoods that are new to me. So I guess in really simple terms, it's the territory we share and the streets and the subway and the geography and the right to the city that connects us. So I don't know. I'm curious to know how Prospect 1 and 2 changed the perspective of people that actually live in New Orleans.
Oh, well, they'll have a lot to tell you about that.
I'm sure.
It was great to see art everywhere, just everywhere you looked. It was a really wonderful time. Now, the book that you've chosen for P3 Reads is The Brilliant Open City by Teju Cole. How did you come to read this novel, and what is it about it that inspires you?
You know, it's funny because you jogged my memory, because I was teaching at Bard College 2 days a week and commuting there on Amtrak. And I met Teju on my commutes, and I had forgotten this. But we caught a ride together. We used to catch a ride from the train to the campus from another professor in the art department where I was teaching. And I guess on those rides, I didn't really get a chance to know him very well, but he seemed so thoughtful and really modest and interesting. And at the time, he was traveling a lot, and he had mentioned in a very offhand way that he was receiving an award for a book that he had written a year earlier called Open City. And I don't think that he actually told me anything about the book, but I was compelled to read it after meeting him. And I think in a large part, my desire to experience the city is somewhat similar as the protagonist of Open City.
So you must have seen a bit of yourself in the protagonist of Open City.
I did. It was really an amazing novel, and I guess I really connect to the wonderful way that he sees, and he strings together the details of life. The protagonist has this unbelievable ability to experience things that he hasn't lived through, and to connect with experiences that he only thought or imagined. I don't know. I'm really interested in the way he was able to weave together the encounters of the city, really only as an outsider can. He's a fascinating character on so many levels. I mean, at times he seems to be really dispassionate and analytical, and at other times he's swept away in a reverie of sensations and thoughts. I also feel that, in part, his unique talent for seeing the city has to do with his really complicated worldview.
And his world is very diverse and fragmented.
I think that a part of that fragmentation has to do with the perspective of the protagonist, who's non-white and who has conflicting issues of race and class. And what's really interesting is the way he uses the secondary characters in the book to flush out contradictions within himself and contradictions about class and race differences. The protagonist sees New York as a flow and not frozen in time, and where things past and present unfold together. And these encounters of difference and observation make it a really, really rich account of a city. As he's walking, he has so many profound reflections. It's almost as if he's found, like, the soul of a city.
Like the great flaneurs of Paris, you know?
yeah, completely, yeah.
So what other literary works have spoken to you in your artistic life?
Huh. Actually, it's really funny that he mentions Borges' story in Open City, and it's one that I actually love a lot and have thought about. The story is called On the Exactitude of Science, and it's the relationship between a map as an abstraction and the map taking the scale of a place, kind of matching detail for detail, and space becoming so tangible. It's just such a provocative image. But then over time, the value of the one-to-one scale of the map to place is lost on generations. So the map is then left to the elements and ruined in the desert and becomes a shelter for beggars and animals. And it's just such a strange and wonderfully sculptural juxtaposition of realities that feeds my work and feeds the way I think about, I guess, artifice and real space.
So I'm curious, because of the way you're talking about these books, when a work of literature inspires you, do you think that as a visual artist you're responding to the words themselves or the visual images you create inside your head as a response? How does that work for you?
Teju Cole's book is very, very different in that I don't know as though I respond to the words themselves, but it may be in the string of images that he brings together. And I mean, especially with Cole's work, it almost seems like he has these two different ways of writing, that one is very literary and one is very plain spoken and almost banal. And, you know, the reason why I felt so connected to his writing was it almost feels like it's nonfiction.
Yes.
It almost feels like it's someone who's really walking through a city, and you're able to see through his time, through his eyes, a reality that could almost be yours, which makes it all the more interesting. But, I mean, in terms of, like, yeah, I guess it's different for different writers. And, you know, with someone like Borges, I think that the imagery is so provocative that that actually can be inspiring, not necessarily to replicate or illustrate that image, mm-hmm. but maybe to somehow find a way to kind of incorporate the idea of the imagery, or the idea of the folly, or the idea of the strangeness of the juxtapositions that happen within the work.
We've been talking with artist Lisa Siegel about the P3 Read series. You can see her in conversation with James Borders IV, Wednesday, February 19th from 6 to 7 at the Norman Mayer Library, 3001 Gentilly. Lisa, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Dawn Ruth Wilson discusses and signs her new mystery, The Nightwalker's Song, Tuesday, February 18th at 6 at Octavia Books. Michael Murphy and contributors Sarah Rowan and Poppy Tooker sign Eat Dat, a guide to the unique food culture of the Crescent City, Tuesday, February 18th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Today's guest, artist Lisa Siegel, is next up in the Prospect 3 reading series. She discusses Teju Cole's Open City with James B. Borders IV, Wednesday, February 19th from 6 to 7 at the Norman Mayer Library, 3001 Gentilly. Today's guest, Wiley Cash, discusses and signs This Dark Road to Mercy, Thursday, February 20th at 6 at Octavia Books. Poet Peter Cooley reads from and signs Night Bus to the Afterlife, Thursday, February 20th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. Dalt Wonk will be on hand to autograph his beautiful card game, The Riddles of Existence. 53 playing cards, each one highlighted by a riddle based on a costume. That's Thursday, February 20th from 6 to 8 at the Ogden Museum of Southern Art. The Dark Days Winter Tour comes to Octavia Books Friday, February 21st at 6 with a stellar lineup of young adult authors, including Tahara Mafi, author of Ignite Me, Kirsten White, author of Perfect Lies, Sophie Jordan, author of Uninvited, Veronica Rossi, author of Into the Still Blue, and Claudia Gray, author of Spellcaster. Elizabeth Canick signs her new book, After the Ball is Over. Mardi Gras designer Larry Youngblood looks back on his 50 years of costumes and memories. Saturday, February 22nd at 1 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. There will be a Mardi Gras open mic reading Sunday, February 23rd at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. Bring beads, everyone. And Lincoln Payne discusses and signs The Sea and Civilization, Tuesday, February 25th at 6 at Octavia Books. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening, and keep reading.